The economist in me said, is there something called optimal hypocrisy?
Welcome to Unintended Consequences, a quarterly podcast about what can go wrong when the government tries to regulate. I'm Paul Matsko, historian and research fellow at the Cato Institute, and I'm joined, as always, by Peter Van Doren, the editor of Regulation Magazine. Our conversation today ranges widely, but the core question behind our discussion is this: how rigorously should we enforce our laws, rules, and norms? Is there such a thing as optimal regulatory hypocrisy? Let's begin with something that most of us take for granted: water. A couple of recent working papers in Regulation Magazine have focused on the surprisingly thorny issues related to water policy, from making sure that we have enough drinking water in arid states to mitigating the damage caused when there's too much water and it floods our homes. It sometimes feels like a case of water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. So I'm of the opinion that water management, you know, at every level, from drinking water, river management, flood risk, might just be the most underrated area of broad government mismanagement, local, state, federal, over the last century. And I don't know if ordinary folks spend a lot of time thinking about the failures of water policy, but we've got two working papers related to water to discuss today, one on flood insurance and one on water markets. And Peter, I think you said you've been working on a book with Ryan Bourne about water management. Maybe you can explain the state of water management policy in the last couple of years.
Well, what's going on is a lot of people have moved to the West, and they are leaving the East, and the West doesn't have much water.
Yeah.
And Phoenix, right, is growing, and Las Vegas are growing tremendously, right? Large population growth in the 2010 to 2020 era. And just as we speak, Arizona has a groundwater management system, and they require housing developments outside of cities, because cities in Arizona have rights to the water from the aqueduct that gets the water from the Colorado River. But outside of those cities, developments have to have 100-year groundwater or water supply management plans. Otherwise, the housing development is not allowed. Well, Maricopa County, the county that surrounds Phoenix, has New York Times announced recently that Maricopa County has realized that the 100-year requirement, now certain planned developments are not able to fulfill that requirement given what they submitted. Well, you'd think, the way that the news reported it is they're running out tomorrow. Well, there's still 80 or 100,000 homes being planned that are already approved. But at the margin, the Times reported that they're going to be 4% short 100 years from now, right? Okay, so we're not ready to jump off the cliff. But the issue of where does water come from? How is it priced? Are there property rights to it? All of that Econ 101 thing. And are the problems with water, do they arise because people think of water as free, right? Or something that just is provided and shouldn't have charges for it and blah, 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 blah. So not only water I want to talk about, but I want to talk about what libertarians think about enforcement. In other words, we talk about policies and passing policies, and then what do we think of the rule of law? Does the rule of law require 100% enforcement, 50% enforcement, benign neglect, to use an old term? So the first working paper is about an experiment in Fresno, California. So Fresno, California has outdoor water restrictions. It's in the West. And it says you can only water your lawn at blah times or blah times a week or things like that. But they only had 5 enforcement officers. So I, in my cutesy little writing style in the new issue of Regulation, I talk about optimal enforcement or non-enforcement or optimal hypocrisy. So Fresno has on the books this thing that says, don't use a lot of water in the summer because we don't have enough because we're in California. Turns out everyone violated this, right? So they then put in automated, computer-readable water meters, okay? And they created an automatic enforcement program, and they had an experiment, and they assigned some people to this, and they assigned some to not. And, well, basically, under the old system, only 0.4% of violators were sanctioned, they concluded, all right? And under the new system, they sent out a lot of citations, and all hell broke loose. So I talked about a thing related, which is speed limits on interstate highways. So in Interstate 270, where I live in suburban Maryland, the posted speed limit is 55 miles an hour. Well, if you go 55, I stated in my review, you'll be rear-ended and people will flash lights at you and the police might even pull you over, right? Because certainly during the pandemic, speeds went up. And my goodness, people go.
And there's been an uptick in fatal crashes because of excessive speeds. People kind of learned to go faster than they should during the pandemic. Yeah, yeah.
And now traffic is rising again and lots of metal cans are bumping into each other.
Yeah, but if you try to enforce the speed limits by a more efficient enforcement mechanism, speed cameras, I assume people don't like that much either.
Oh, they hate, yeah, no, yeah. I mean, right? And so anyway, Fresno did this and the S hit the fan and the city council repealed. It said, no fine shall be administered based on water meter readings. And it's like, what? So I talk about optimal hypocrisy and whether or not we should think about, in other words, if politics is a ventilation device where activists get stuff, and libertarians might be opposed to lots of the stuff they get, although I don't think speed limits would fall in that category, but is having something on the books and not enforcing it very much, I think of that as it's a positive political equilibrium. That is, I could find lots of examples of said stuff all over the place. And is that, what do we think of that?
Because you can make a libertarian argument on either side, right? Ultimately, where on the one hand, one of the issues with water we're talking about is the government prices water below the market rate. It subsidizes it in a variety of ways. It subsidizes it for, I don't know, almond farmers in California, and so they pay sub-market rates for these water-intensive crops, and that's a problem. So, like, on the one hand, you can make a libertarian argument based on market thinking that we need a functioning market for water that properly prices water. Mm-hmm. And in the absence of a real functioning market, we have the government saying use less, which is a lot less effective than the market if you just price the water, you know, more accurately. But on, you know, people dodging prices, they want water to be as cheap as possible, cheaper than the market, cheaper than the government's trying to make it for them. There is something kind of counter-libertarian in that regard. On the flip side, you know, defying government minders, you know, the meter maids coming around and right, reading. There's also kind of a small L libertarian, like, stick it to the man. You know, use the phrase benign neglect. And one of the classic dangers of benign neglect, I mean, in at least in among historians, we use that term to refer to British trade policy in the 18th century, that the British had all these trade restrictions that, you know, goods had to be transshipped through, you know, that raised the cost of goods for American consumers in the colonies in the 1700s. And that they mostly didn't enforce them during a big span in the middle of the 18th century. And so Americans got used to not abiding by these rules. And so when they finally tried to follow the actual law, I mean, these were legitimate laws passed by Parliament that they just didn't enforce. They actually started trying to enforce them. They get a revolution. And there's a moral to the story there. Like, we have in a very small scale revolutions in these, you know, because they're used to not having to pay real prices for water. They're used to not having to abide by speeding restrictions.
But I think, would you agree that real world political systems have a lot of, let's call it, enforcement hypocrisy? And therefore, the economist in me said, is there something called optimal hypocrisy? But a libertarian view might be that it's zero. for a while it works, but then, oh boy, you use the word I mean,
again, it's kind of a, you know, we have a debate here between what kind of libertarian one is, right? There is a, I call it vulgar libertarianism, which is just the government should leave me alone, let me do what I want to do. And it should prevent other people from telling me that I can't do what I want to do. And that's fine. And it's actually fine for the government to tell other people not to do things that I don't like. It's just leave me and mine alone.
Right.
You can bother they and them. In fact, I wouldn't mind if you did because I don't like.
Political parties are organized to bother people you don't like.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. So there's kind of a vulgar libertarianism that I think is a commonality in across the ideological spectrum in American politics, whether people would describe themselves that way or not. I think a lot of our water systems are very underrated, the extent to which all of our municipal infrastructure was actually often built by private capital. Like here in the Trenton area, Trenton Water Works started with, you know, business interests, pooled together capital and built the Trenton Water Works. It was later municipalized and it's being run into the ground over the last half century by the government authority, you know, in charge of it.
There is a story for our listeners we should tell, which is the EPA, all the grants to local folks for water improvements. At some point in the 70s, I don't know off the top of my head, but at some point you couldn't get federal money unless you couldn't be private. So we had lots of private water systems, and the conversion of them to the water agencies that we now know and deal with was not an accident, or it was a product of well, people like federal money and the willingness to not have federal money is slim. It's like an education, right? There's certain colleges that do not accept any federal financial aid for their students or federal grants for them. That allows them to not be governed by any of the affirmative action or other kind of federal rules. So same thing with water.
Well, and then once it's municipalized, once it's, you know, becomes a government run utility, there's political pressure not to raise rates to reflect the actual costs of running that water system or sewer system or whatever.
Yes.
And often that means, you know, they're only, and maybe there'll be enough to cover operating costs, but they're not amortizing future capital or infrastructure replacement. And so then eventually a big bill comes due generations of politicians later. That's what's happening all across the country.
Yes. Because
right
our
now.
Systems are.
Because half a century ago, we did this.
They're 100. Yeah. As New York, as you said, was 100 and some odd years old. And we're heading, this happening where I live, the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission, WSSC. There was a big water main on River Road that blew up, oh, 6 years, 5 years ago. It was a 60-incher or something, a 48. I mean, right? Huge. Road fell apart, no water. And then everyone, it finally came out that the water agency was replacing water mains on a 300-year schedule. The depreciation was a bit in the slow lane rather than the fast lane. Well, anyway, they have raised rates 10% per, right? In real terms, my water bill's gone up a lot. And it's everyone's griping. And it's not about the water. It's about the fixed costs of replacing these things on a timely basis so that they don't fall apart.
And if it was a private entity, they, you know, they usually are better at accounting for those future expenses in their, you know, in their account keeping. And
yes, because they have shareholders and there's profits and right.
Yeah. So that's one of the, it is a feature, not a bug in government run utility systems, including water. So we should, when possible, privatize these systems. Of course, usually what happens when you do so, when you privatize a water system, is that they then are they're doing it because the local government is desperate. And so you're turning it private at exactly the moment when they need to start raising rates. And so then, people blame the privatization for greedflation. Greedy capitalists are coming along and exploiting taxpayers. So the reality is they're cleaning up the mess left by government mismanagement. But we also live in the real world, which is that not all water systems are going to be privatized. So in these government-run water systems where water has not been accurately priced for decades, there is no functioning there's a very poorly functioning water market. What do you do in those suboptimal situations?
But you're right for the Fresno. I mean, you were right to point out that the Greenstone paper talks about how automated enforcement fell apart. What the article does not talk about is that water wasn't priced. I mean, why was use so high? And the answer is because the water wasn't priced correctly. And in fact, there's evidence, well, even though they had meters, there weren't prices at all. It was just embedded in the municipal budget.
I worked for a local water and sewer authority for a summer after college, and which was quite an experience for like a 22-year-old, you know, to no one ever calls the water authority because they're happy with things. No one said, hey, Mr. Matsko, I just want to let you know my water's really good, sweet, and tastes great today. Thank you guys so much for what you do. That was always, you know. But one of the things you realize is working behind the scenes is how even relatively functioning water systems, how the whole game is kind of rigged in ways that violate a simple market. Like, imagine if the prices you paid for anything was just based on your political influence. So in our water system, if you were the more water you used, it didn't just become cheaper. And you'd expect, I don't know, a bulk discount of some kind. It became exponentially cheaper. So the people who paid the most were the people who used the least, but by an exponential factor. So if you're a little residential home, your rate was very high. If you were a big business, a factory using lots of water for your industrial process, you paid, I mean, not quite 100x, but 10x less if you're a big user. And I know this in California, the same kind of thing with farms. The farms, you know, they have these water-intensive agricultural crops, and they pay pennies on the dollar compared to residential users, which is because they have a lot of heft. You know, California politics going back to the early Sunbelt days, agricultural interests have a lot of pull in the state capital.
In fact, the Bureau of Water Reclamation, I can talk a bit about the chapter I wrote for Ryan Bourne. Basically, there's actually a common law origin of farmers' rights where they were the first to divert from the rivers and they developed
first dibs.
Yep. Aqueduct systems. So it's analogous to the way property rights for land were created. So the property rights for river diversion under U.S. common law were based on I'm here first and I diverted it for a beneficial use and I get to do that. So then the Federal Bureau of Water Reclamation comes along and subsidizes and builds a whole lot more of that stuff out there. So that's why farmers have access to and use a lot of water, and all they pay for is literally some sort of federal interest rate on the capital structures that are allegedly paid for their use, the dams and the aqueducts. There's nothing in principle, though, that prevents, in fact, that's the issue that now in the West is, farmers are often to blame in the press. And you just gave a great layperson's understanding of said problem, which is we subsidize them and that's not right. Technically, though, from an economist's point of view, the fact that they have initial property rights isn't the problem. It's that if we allow them to get rich from trading those rights to urban users, that solves the problem. But it's also culturally difficult to do. And the history of it, diverting water to LA and to Phoenix is about said conflicts because the farmers get rich from selling the thing that many think they shouldn't have been entitled to in the first place, the subsidized system. To an economist, that's just sunk, that's just there. It's there. Here's how we deal with it. Create rights to the water and then allow them to be traded. And water's priced per acre foot. Do you know, we have to, so that's, and it's, I forget how many hundreds of thousands of gallons. Yeah, it's an acre of land with a foot of water depth. That's an acre foot. So farmers pay, I don't know, in the 30s. And then if you sell it to San Diego, it's in the thousands, right? The San Diego water system is paying farmers in the Central Valley 10 times, 100 times more. So farmers get rich from the fact that we subsidize them. To an economist, it's like, oh, all right, get it. I mean, we just got to do that. It's in the past. Forget about it. But culturally, that...
It's uncouth. It's not how we should do things. It's, well, you know, it to use the you know, political equilibrium, if the point of politics is to ventilate disagreements between communities, well, that the old system makes a certain degree of sense when, you know, up until the mid-19th century, what, 90% of Americans are engaged in agricultural-related enterprises? And so a system that benefits 90%. And, you know,
it wasn't us and them. There was just us.
Just us. All farmers. We're 90% of us are basically farmers. But today it's, well, you know, 2% or something crazy, or actually, you know, so the political equilibrium hasn't updated, or it has updated, but not the system that, you know, based on the old political equilibrium is still there.
The solution to water problems in the West and the Colorado and too many people having rights relative to the current flows, eventually we'll trade all these rights and price them. But it's a slog because of the distributional concerns over who gets the gains from the trades. And then, separately, we have to developing underground water property rights systems is more difficult than surface, because
for the aquifers and
you have to have a central manager. You have what's called a unitization problem, right? Because too many straws in the drink problem. And so you have to actually have a hydrologist do studies and figure out, well, given the rainfall rate and given the recharge rate of the aquifer, what's the sustainable water use that can occur from this thing without negative effects. In fact,
depleting it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you deplete it too fast, you not only run out of water, but the land sinks. There's a town in California that has sunk 11 feet.
Wow.
The New York Times had a story earlier this year on it. It symbolizes for them the
climate
water
change or something. Probably.
Yes. Yeah, but yeah. Anyway, the getting farmers to then agree to a master of an aquifer who then allocates water rights. One of the working papers in the next issue is on that, how that worked out in Idaho. And Idaho is a very conservative state, very market-oriented state, and yet it took 27 years to...
This is the Brown and G economic value of clarifying property rights from Idaho's Snake River Basin. Okay.
Correct.
Okay. Yep.
And again, to the what the listener should understand is, yes, in theory, it's, quote, easy to say prices, we ought to have prices in markets. But the actual practice of developing property rights that are exchangeable for underground water sources is incredibly difficult. It's not you can't just assign the right to drill based on surface property rights, because everyone affects everyone else, because there's just one underground source of water and the surface property rights don't equal the surface area of the reservoir. So in Idaho, anyway, it took 27 years and 90 some odd million dollars of a statewide judicial adjudication effort. And it's great. I mean, it costs $94 million, and now Idaho agriculture has $250 million per year in benefits. But it took 27 years. All right.
So
the normal Cato listener who says, oh, they just should listen to us and prices and markets and it all work out. In the water area, both in the surface development, the development of the tradable rights, and then underground developing of rights and then trading them, is what we call transaction cost filled. It's just difficult. So we are going to have a tough slog going forward imagine non-market oriented, right? Like California. Arizona's market oriented, so it may be easier then. But if it takes as long as Idaho, remember, Idaho doesn't have many people, doesn't have many cities. And this was just conflicts among farmers over the water rights. And so
what are they spending the money on? Like the $94 million. So you have
literally
know,
creating a title system to creating something analogous to a land title system.
rather like than just, I've always extracted water from my fields, being like, you have a right to X amount of gallons each year, and that you have a quantifiable legal, you know, document that states that kind of thing, or adjudicatable.
Correct. Okay. Correct. Like, how do we know who owns what land and have There's housing and land markets?
Piece of paper in a, you know, government office, that your deed, right?
And that happened so long ago, none of us know about it. Well, for water, we're doing that now. And it turns out it is, my review of this working paper of Idaho is stunning in the numbers involved. And it's a small rural state where there's fairly homogeneous political beliefs. And yet,
still took 27 years and $94 million.
7 years to...
Now do that for Los Angeles County, right?
So stay tuned. The world is shifting in our direction, but it's not as easy as implementing some of our other views in markets that aren't priced very well.
Well, my understanding is the paper said it works. It said 140% increase in optimal use. I mean, all the good metrics went up. I'm not sure. Right? The water seemed better allocated. And
exactly. This is worth it. It's not. There's no mischief here. It's just the Econ 101 sort of view of, oh, come on, guys. There's just property rights and markets and prices, and it'll all work. Well, the actual, as you said, the infrastructure of creating water, underground water property rights, is difficult, even if everyone agrees it should occur.
It's interesting. I come from a strange, like, my approach to libertarianism is very historically grounded, which it rather than theoretical. And there's value in a theoretical approach, value in economics approach, value in historical approach. But I'm always struck by the ways in which you have to remember, like, when you think about these struggles, these debates as historical matters, in a place and time, this had to be evolved in a messy real world way. It wasn't just someone said, oh, fee simple property. That's a thing now. Everyone has, you know, absolute right to their own domain, right? That, like, that had to be evolved through a process of struggle and politics over centuries, ultimately.
The transition ages. From feudalism to said system, it wasn't
right. And like, we kind of take it for granted that we have good ideas, and we do, right? But like, you actually have to, it's a process to get those ideas to happen in a historical way. And so, like, I'm thinking here of, you know, it's one thing, you know, we might be familiar with the tragedy of the commons, you know, Garrett Hardin's idea that you get suboptimal usage of a resource because, you know,
underground water.
It's hard. It's it's not even easy to enclose a literal commons that he's thinking of, the village commons in the middle of town where you're grazing your sheep on. That was a hard process. Lots of resistance and struggle and, you know, time. But you could do it. You could put fences. We talk enclosure is not just a metaphor. It's literal, right? You fence it off. How do you fence off an aquifer, right? It's a really hard thing to do.
You turn over. See, here's, oddly, there's this a very big scientific component. You turn over the management of said thing to a hydrologist, to a hydrology agency, where everyone then has to agree to what the scientists say about the recharge rate of this underground water system, i.e., there's this much rainfall and the rivers leak this, well, not leak, that's not the right word, you know, that river flow, if you, in the Idaho, there was the Snake River, and turns out diversion of the river by agricultural interests slows down the recharge rate of the underground aquifer in Idaho as well, which I did not know that surface river systems are related to the recharge rate of underground water systems. So literally, smart people have to figure out what this underground pool is like and how much of it you can use a year to keep it sustainable. Then you have to divvy up that amount amongst hundreds of thousands of users. And then you have to take into account their historical quote, well, I was sort of doing this, and if you take away a lot of what I was doing, I'm going to fight. Right? Do you see what I, right? And that took Idaho 27 years and hundreds of thousands of cases before judges who were then informed by this scientific hydrology entity that Idaho allows to manage its underground water system. So you and I agree that within our Cato community, you and I are more on the empirical, I'm empirical and you're historical, rather than theory. And so the notion that Ayn Rand said X, and therefore if everyone read Ayn Rand, it would sort of just work out. Well,
proliferates.
The details take 27 years.
It turns out
that's different from supermarkets or whatever for food. But as you said, what you and I don't realize is what a slog it was to develop the systems of land title, because we now just take it for granted that there's this thing we get from the county when you borrow your rent your house that says somebody owns it. And then a surveyor has surveyed it. Surveying, right? All of that. George Washington.
Well, so we have another paper here. This is the Efficient Adaption to Flood Risk by Hovekamp and Wagner, about flood insurance. So we're kind of on the other side. So we've been talking about too little water. Now we could talk about managing what happens when there's too much water. So my general understanding as a non-expert is that for a long time, the federal government runs the flood insurance system poorly, hurricane insurance system. Eventually started to realize it's insuring too many houses that get repeatedly flooded and rebuilt because they're on a floodplain. They shouldn't probably build a house there. And it gets destroyed. They rebuild it, destroyed, rebuild it. And it's all kind of subsidized by the taxpayer, which is nuts. So the feds try to stem the bleeding. They come up with new rules to prevent repeat offenders. They try to minimize how often they're having to rebuild houses in floodplains. And my understanding, that's the background for this paper. Do I have that right?
Yes, a little. I'll just amend a little amendment, which is the giveaway part. Congress knows itself, and Congress knows that it has difficulty saying no to voters. But members have to be reelected. So believe it or not, Congress tries now and then to have what game theory people like me would call commitment devices. One is the Constitution of the United States. That's a big commitment device. But in flood insurance, from the beginning, when the program was designed in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a provision in the law that said if the damage to a structure equals or exceeds 50% of the market value of the structure has to be elevated above the 100-year floodplain in order to receive payments from the flood insurance program. So, and in fact, the Congress was naive, but it believed that this provision, this commitment to you have to elevate if you receive payments, would eventually allow the flood insurance program payment system to go away. There would be no, right? If we start out with flooding and low structures and then all new structures,
they're all above that level,
and all rebuilt structures have to be elevated, then the flood insurance problem goes away. Okay, so it was a commitment device.
It's reasonable in theory. How'd it work in practice?
Well, it's hard staying committed to the commitment device, right? This is game theory within game theory. There's just commitment from there on down. And when big stuff happened, Congress then throws money at stuff. And it's hard to, Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, we threw $14 billion at a place that did not have $14 billion worth of flood insurance. So the origins were was a commitment device, but it is. And Congress has really tried now and then to crack down. What was the hurricane that hit New York in 2012?
Oh, that Sandy? Was Camilla. Sandy.
So flood insurance reform occurred before that, and then Hurricane Sandy hit, and then that led to a reluctance of the New York and the New Jersey delegations to follow through with said elevation requirements. And anyway, we're still wrestling with exceptions to all that. But the Hovekamp paper is a a very narrow but important question, which is, has anyone explored the economics of the cost effectiveness of the elevation requirement? And what they did is a nice research design, and they used the randomness of the timing of the flood plans in Florida. And some places were covered and some places weren't. And then you study, were the rebuilding costs less once structures had been elevated? And was the elevation cost less than the present value of the benefits from being elevated, right? A classic cost-benefit question. And the answer for new structures was yes, right? Structures that were elevated and then had flood insurance claims, the claims were not much. They were small. And so the cost of the elevation was worth it. Then they examine how about for the existing structures, right? Old structures and then making them elevated. Turns out that's expensive. So that cost $40,000 or $50,000 a structure and only yielded like $9,000 or $8,000 in benefits, something like that. And so that was instructive to me because I wrote a paper for Cato a year, year and a half ago on what should we do about this mandate to raise structures once they pull a permit that equals half the market value of the structure, right? Old structures in flood zones. Is it cost effective to elevate them? And the answer from this paper was no, it is not. So, wow. So that's so should you abandon the structure? What should you do? Should we buy them out and make them leave? But elevation is not, it costs more than the damages that it prevents for existing structures because the elevation cost is so high.
Our next discussion topic is a little more abstract. The federal government employs many hundreds of economists who are expected to help policymakers understand the economic consequences of proposed laws and new regulations. The question that Stuart Shapiro has asked in the latest issue of Regulation is whether economists should be neutral actors in policy discussions rather than advocates. That question is complicated by the simple fact that there are different competing definitions of what neutrality even is in the first place. So I'll put the question to you, Peter. What does it mean to you that a bureaucrat, in this case an economist, should be neutral?
Well, this is the deep intellectual question of what is policy analysis. I mean, is it scientific? And what's the difference between positive science? I mean, what is science? What is expertise? And we could use the term just follow the science was used during the pandemic. You could substitute just follow the economists, right? In this notion of neutrality. The agency that epitomizes this most, and Shapiro interviewed people in it, is the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO. And listeners probably, every time a bill occurs or the CBO, quote, scores a bill, right? It scores the congressional decisions on regulation and on budgets, on spending. And scoring a bill means using a computer model to estimate the effects of spending and taxation on, fill in the blanks, behavior out there in the economy. And this, at its core, is what positive economics is about, rather than normative, right? That if we understand the relationship between prices and behavior, and we understand the relationship between tax rates and willingness to pay taxes, and we understand, right, we have these, it's what are called the values of fundamental parameters, right? It's a fancy econ word for if prices do this and revenues do this, and then what follows in a market? If we actually know all that stuff, then if you plug in the what a bill would do, if you put all the ifs into a computer model, and then it spits out the thens, right? The if this and if that, then GDP will be X and revenues will be Y, and something called net benefits to the economy will be blah. So that's what Shapiro means by neutrality, which is I have models of the economy and I'm trained in them. And we think we know how markets work, and we have both micro and macro models about the money supply and this and that and the other thing. And then what happens if we do this to taxes or interest rates and the following? And then, boom, out comes our 10-year prediction of the answer, right? That's how CBO scores a bill.
But interested parties will always assume the best case scenario and exaggerate to match because it's politically useful to do so. So I guess the question then is, so if you're the CBO, neutrality, what does that mean? Does it mean using the Republican preferred inflection point for Laffer? Does it mean using the gets messy?
Shapiro argues that when he interviews these folks in CBO and the other in OMB and the Economic Research Service of the Department of Agriculture, and the GAO, right? He has four agencies where nerds hang out. And he argues they have an ethos of scientism and neutrality. And the unpleasant details that we are now describing are not part of that are not part of the view. In other words, the the underlying intellectual disputes within economics, which are real, are not part of the perspective of scientific neutrality for outward purposes. In other words, when an agency says, we've done this, we've investigated everything clearly, and we've talked to lots of people, and we've concluded this bill does the following, the fact that in a graduate seminar, the professor would admit, well, economics and models, computer models, are assumption dependent. And if our parameters and our assumptions are incorrect, then the output, the layman's view of this is garbage in, garbage out, right? For a negative portrayal of models. That messy, real intellectual business isn't part of the lay of the land when an official government so-called neutral entity does its scientism. I've done econometrics. I know where I know what people do to get stuff to work. I know the assumptions that one makes. And so to actually get at causality, to actually make economics be like science, like physics or chemistry, where we know an additional dollar of tax revenue does the following to fill in the blank. That's hard. I mean, yeah, we can sort of do it, but we can't to the extent that the CBO official statements suggest.
Portray as, yeah. But well, I think our colleague, Deirdre McCloskey, would be pulling her hair out right now. At the basic proposition that econ is a science. So it's interesting as someone in a kind of adjacent field, right? So in history, we're humanities, right? But back in the day, oftentimes history departments were in the social sciences departments back in the early 20th century, along with econ. So econ and history, sociology were considered scientific fields. And history moved away from that because we recognize that it's not really a science in any meaningful way. I think Shapiro touches on this where he says, like, neutrality, he has two different classes of neutrality he talks about, right? So you can think of neutrality as scientism, that scientish-ish fields like econ and public health are the two examples he uses. You know, it's about bringing expert knowledge to bear on public policy, which is an interesting definition of science because science is not actually defined by expertise. Science is a process. It's, you know, double-blind studies and a repeatable, falsifiable process, not actually expertise. I mean, you know, a theologian has expertise in the, you know, in theology, but that doesn't mean that it's scientific that they study God, right? You know? But there is that sense of like, just follow the science, but we don't really mean science. We mean listen to people who have expertise, and by expertise, we mean people who have degrees from a handful of influential universities and have a lots of experience, which again, so there's a lot of slippage here, but that's one conception of neutrality. Just let the experts, the economists at OMB, make their rulings, follow, you know, and that's neutrality. Or his other idea of neutrality is not taking a position as an economist at the OMB and just giving the results that the elected officials want to hear. Because they're the ones who have the democratic mandate. Your job is to give them,
right.
Listen to them.
In a democracy, elected officials decide and bureaucracies implement.
And so these are two, you know, discrete definitions of neutrality that often could come into conflict. And I think Shapiro does a good job kind of noting, you know, what examples of the conflict between these conceptions come to your mind, Peter?
Well, I remember that this BBC show, Yes Minister, which you can catch on reruns, and it's about this conflict, which is the premise of the show is that they don't use the word, but the deep state really runs everything. And then the elected officials are just fools who don't have any influence over anything, right? In particular, Republican elected officials often want to end or terminate or reduce government in various ways and end programs. Well, to the extent that programs are run by experts, and then this notion of the bureaucracy as being, as in Yes Minister, right? The experts have decided we need food stamps or the earned income tax credit or fill in the blank, the large transfer state or the large military establishment. And well, I'm elected on a platform of getting rid of that. Then I think the administrative state, the bureaucracy will resist.
Should do what I want. Yeah.
And Yes Minister is the cultural expression of that. But Nixon, right, there was a whole scholarship on Nixon and the administrative presidency, his sense that the bureaucracy was against him. A scholar named Richard Nathan that I taught with at Princeton wrote a book on this. Trump is bringing back all the old Nixon versus the bureaucracy issues. And the Shapiro notion of expertise is kind of a part of, right? It's all wrapped up in this.
Well, as a historian, the bit that spoke to me was where he talked about, he started with an observation about the civil service reform movement in the 1880s. And again, we kind of take for granted a system in which bureaucrats, they might be annoying and they might be slow to do stuff we want them to do, but we kind of think of them as relatively disinterested parties, maybe corruptible parties.
And it's hard for current people to realize that was a solution.
We wanted them to be kludgy and not responsive. They used to be overly responsive, right? Because back in the first half of American history, it's the spoils system. The president wins, and so all the bureaucrats, like down to the level of postmaster, was a reward for being a faithful party member. Like, you know, the entire bureaucracy would turn over every presidential election cycle. And just the level of, I mean, to call it corruption implies that there's some alternative. But the whole system was, and then those bureaucrats paid assessments to the parties for in exchange for getting the position. So as long as you were the postmaster, whatever, you were supposed to chip in your dues back to the political party, which that was their primary source of campaign funds once upon a time. That persisted for another 50, 60 years in Boston and Chicago and Philly. It's funny how much, like, if you're worried about municipal corruption, and there are still lots of instances of municipal corruption today, but it's so piecemeal compared to even half a century ago.
Exactly. I mean, everything was for sale, and now only certain things
are now for only certain sale. Things, yeah. Yeah. And for certain people who haven't, you know. Yeah. It's funny to think of this current moment in this debate over, I think Trump has promised that if he wins, he'll use something called Schedule F powers to turn a bunch of civil service positions that were in the 1880s were meant to be these like lifelong, non-political appointees. They're supposed to be non-responsive to the turnover at the top. I think 50,000 positions he's promised to turn into kind of at-will, kind of spoil system kinds of positions. So it's interesting. We're in this moment where there's an interest, I don't know whether it actually happened, but there's an interest in turning back the clock to kind of a pre-1880s understanding of how the administrative state is supposed to function.
a phrase by Yogi Berra comes to mind. It's deja vu all over again. And it's, again, I, you and I enjoy talking with each other because even though I'm a analytic policy econ data guy, I have learned over time that whenever I read history, I realize, oh my God, there's nothing new. We've been wrestling with this stuff forever. The econ part of me, though, says there's an optimal relationship between layperson elected decision making and something called expertise that can inform you that, oh, you may want this and you were elected to do this, but it's going to F everything up in ways you have no idea and you shouldn't do this, right? I mean, so an article in the spring issue of Regulation we haven't talked about, an author named Judge Glock wrote an article. That's not, he's not a judge. That's his name.
That's just his name. Yeah.
It's not honorific. He wrote an article on, and it was just fascinating to me, on the origins of so-called independent commissions, right? The FTC and the ICC, these, again, bureaucracies. And we now think of them as involving something called expertise, right? We think of the, and he argues the origins were not at all about that. And it was, what I did not know is railroad, again, industrialization and then railroads and railroad rates. It turns out under common law, juries were impaneled all the time under common law to fuss about railroad rates. And that just led to great uncertainty for railroads, right? You never, I mean, how do we know what prices are going to be? So
they actually welcomed having a commission that would routinize the process.
And it wasn't that the commissions would be expert.
No.
It was experienced. It was simply that they would deal with railroad rates across a whole series of cases. So they weren't always doing random stuff that juries would do. And I said, oh. And then progressives turned those original railroad commissions into
technocratic,
yes,
like rule by administrative
state. That
was
not the origins. And
that's interesting.
And then as a libertarian, again, where I like common law and I sort of like juries. And then, again, this notion that the people have a good sense about them, but having them rule under common law and railroad rates, I guess, from this article, just messed everything up from a management pricing standpoint.
I'm not the most quantitatively inclined kind of guy, right? I tell stories as a historian. And so this gets down to the realm of the squishy. And the squishy here is that culture matters. And so I was struck by, you can't, you know, it's hard to guardrail culture. It's hard to make culture do things. Culture is usually invisible. It's often, you know, symbols.
Even though I believe in it, I'm very ambivalent about how does one measure.
It's
what does
hard
it
to
mean
measure.
To measure, even though
or I, hard to change or hard to channel, or that, you know, Shapiro goes and he interviews these folks and kind of assesses the internal culture of
correct.
These groups of economists there.
Correct.
And but I wouldn't dismiss that. That has real value.
I agree.
Because a lot of this, you know, adjudicating the proper balance of responsiveness versus expertise in your definition of neutrality comes down to something that kind of has to be created on the fly, ideally by people with firm sets of principles and a commitment to kind of the best of both worlds. And you can't formalize that. You can try. I mean, you can create regulations that mandate neutrality, but that's not actually going to get you what you're looking for necessarily. So it matters that these economists think of themselves as nonpartisan. They think of themselves as kind of not taking, as being fair and objective to the questions they're studying, even if they have points of view. The fact that they're trying to be neutral, it matters as much as whether they actually are neutral or not, in a sense.
We haven't used the term state of the art. Right. So if in economics, what we know changes over time, and then, oh, yeah, we would have done it this way back then, but now a good professional would not use that kind of model to come up with that answer because of this article and this article and this article said the econometrics are BS. Believe it or not, I mean, there are articles in the AER, and I've talked to my colleagues about them, which argue that the fed in the 70s, this, you know, again, too much or too little money growth, and was it political, and did Nixon get the Fed to try to win real, and all that stuff. That a more benign, I mean, an example that I have read in a journal article is that the models of the time were insufficiently aware of supply constraints, and they thought the money supply increases they were approving of at the time, according to their models. It's not that they wanted to impose inflation on them. It just, they were surprised that it happened, and their models were inappropriate and inaccurate. And they thought they could do what they did and recommended what they did because the models told them, and they did not understand that the models were in fact wrong. And that's a more benign view than, but notice they had this, the Shapiro, they had the notions then of trying to do it right, but in real time, doing it right within a scientific enterprise, one can be wrong. And not, and then updating over time, you realize, oh, we don't do that anymore. But we really thought this was the way to do it at the time. So again, when lay people criticize expertise, sometimes the lay people are right. See what they are? It's not just a values fight. It's literally their intuition about what they're seeing out there. I mean, for example, the recent bout of inflation we had, right? Sort of. People knew it before the Fed knew it.
Before they admitted it. Yeah,
because
You can see it. You're in touch. You go to the grocery store. Well, it's kind of a classic, you know, I mean, as libertarians, we love talking about the problems with central, you know, with command economies, central management, the knowledge problem, Hayek. And this is kind of a classic version that the crowd sourced information, if you will, the crowd wisdom that there's inflation going on, even if the central, you know, data gatherers, in this case, you know, I guess the economists at whatever organization, they don't see it yet because they're still gathering data or because it doesn't fit their model. So there's kind of a libertarian point there. And so I guess the importance then is to not create a closed epistemic model that you don't want to give. So maybe some utility in giving them the ability and the freedom to generate models, to generate estimates and so on, but you don't want to completely close them off from outside information and from, you know, I guess dissent or from some sort of public check. Like full technocratic management here would have been a disaster, arguably.
It's always a disaster, but you may not know it. I mean,
yeah.
This is again where we started out talking about optimal hypocrisy, and now it's optimal dissent. How do you know? So reform, scientific understanding comes from dissent, comes from the wackos. But sorting the wackos into the wackos you'll eventually come around to believe were right versus the large number of wackos that were in fact just wrong, doing that in real time, it's wow. Type one and type two errors. That's my story on life. And you don't know which error is worse until it happens. And then,
you know, when it came, for example, to COVID, to the pandemic, how did we respond to the pandemic? Well, the public health experts, and they are experts in public health, they, using their expertise, made a series of recommendations, some of which we now know were very wrong. Like, don't mask. We were told not to mask for 3/4 of a year. That was the wrong recommendation. But I think, you know, in some cases, that was a recommendation made in good faith based on expertise and experience with past pandemics.
We think it was wrong. The real world clinical trials on masks, right?
Have been less significant results.
Yes,
than we
because
thought, right?
In the real world, real mask wearing isn't very good. If we could, and then there's laboratory use of masks with volatile particles and lasers showing if people really did this the way they should, and we could implement that perfectly in the real world, mask wearing or the right kind of mask would reduce the transmission of droplets in ways that would have to reduce infection, right? Notice both are true.
Yeah,
which is more relevant?
Right, right. There was a whiplash from the public health recommendations on masking from normal people.
Correct.
Shouldn't mask at all. In fact, it's bad to mask.
In fact, because of their understanding of droplets and at the time was...
And so on. Two, everyone should mask constantly.
Right.
And so there's somewhere in the middle is the truth, right? And the gradations. So, but that was based on expertise. They got it wrong and then maybe they got it more right or maybe not. But we can argue about all that. But as The Economist point out, and Shapiro points out, there's no cost-benefit analysis here. Like, what's the economic cost of various shutdown measures?
Public health does not like
cost-benefit. But I'm also struck by, yet again, by the limits. So the expertise we're talking about here is all economics. But an economist can tell you a certain kind of cost or benefit, but not about what costs people are willing to bear and what benefits people really want in light of those costs. So, does a lockdown measure that decreases the spread of COVID by X amount, The Economist comes along and says that X amount costs this much financially, but that still doesn't tell you whether you should do it or not, which is a matter of ethics, of preferences, of...
Well, in particular, what economics... So we can talk about the cost per life saved of a public health measure if implemented in such a way that it's blah percent effective, right? We could
we could
come up with that.
You come up with
a
number.
And then we could say we now use the $10 million per life saved as a kind of threshold. Things that cost more than that are, quote, not cost effective. Things below that are cost effective and should be implemented.
Right, but
then there's a footnote. Then there's a footnote, which is this does not count any of the things that aren't priced, i.e., freedom or things, because the right to be stubborn or the right to go on a motorcycle without a helmet. Now, a public health person would say that's kind of stupid. My wife was an ER nurse, and Connecticut at the time didn't have a helmet law. And at intersections,
a lot of motorcycles, I imagine. Oh,
and
man.
At intersections, she would hand out her business card to motorcyclists without helmets and say, "You're going to see me, and you're not going to have a spine that works, and you're going to be on a ventilator, and you're going to blah 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 blah." Okay, but then is it worth it to be stupid and not follow expertise, right?
Or is it worth it to be the kind of society that allows such people to make stupid decisions, which is a whole nother layer of...
For many people, there's an obvious answer, but for libertarians, it's...
I think the phrase Peter was reaching for is, it's complicated, which really could be the catchphrase of our show. But I find that the complicated questions are often the most interesting ones as well. If you're still listening, then you probably think so too. And if you enjoyed this conversation, it's just the tip of the iceberg for what's in the latest issue of Regulation Magazine, which you can read for free online at cato.org/regulation. Thank you to Landriers for producing the pod. And as always, until next time, be well.